This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is USA Today, Hour 1, Part A, this Friday, February 16, 2024. I'm Tom Breed, reading on behalf of Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired and Radio Reading Services. We'll begin with the Week in Review, which is a review of the top stories that have occurred this week. Greenland's ice sheet is melting so fast it's being replaced by, well, greenery. According to research out of the UK this week, parts of the Arctic Territory are turning to shrubbery for the first time since the Vikings visited 1,000 years ago, the study says. And the cause is global warming. About 11,000 square miles of the island's ice sheet and glaciers, an area bigger than Massachusetts, have melted in the past three decades, the study says. One year after Upstart, the farmer dog, stole the hearts of the Super Bowl audience in USA Today's ad meter contest. The title went to a corporate giant featuring a pair of two-legged veteran actors, State Farm spot reuniting Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito. First paired in the 1988 movie Twins, was the winner, featuring the Australian-born Schwarzenegger as a State Farm employee in an action film who keeps mangling the company's tagline, like a good neighbor, only to be bailed out by his old pal, Danny DeVito. In second was Duncan, followed by Kia, Uber Eats, and the NFL. Almost continuing with the Week in Review, almost a decade after he left his desk at Comedy Central, The Daily Show, Jon Stewart was back where he seemingly belongs. Monday, in a role as weekly guest host for the Emmy-winning news program, he turned into a cultural touchstone. Why am I back? I have committed a lot of crimes, he told the audience before launching a signature blank face pause skewer fest on the usual suspects, Donald Trump, the Super Bowl, and yes, Joe Biden. In a year, election 2024, electoral dysfunction, that promises to give him plenty of material. The Kansas City Chiefs are Super Bowl champs again. And in the minds of many, now unquestionably, they are a dynasty, led by Super Bowl MVP Patrick Mahomes and some late heroics from tight end Travis Kelce. The Chiefs captured their third trophy in 5 years, now including back-to-back titles, by beating the San Francisco 49ers 25-22 in overtime. It was a thrilling finish to a game that started slowly, with the Chiefs down 10-0 in the second quarter. The guys never faltered, Mahomes said later. This is awesome. It is legendary. Now turning to the front page, Steadfast Mission, Fight Like Hell for Vets. It's one of the most iconic photos from Barack Obama's 8 years in the White House. There's the president looking grave in the Situation Room as he and a small group of aides watch a live feed of the Special Operations Forces raid that killed Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The small room is packed with two cabinet secretaries, top generals, and Obama's vice president, Joe Biden. And there, sitting opposite Obama, just to the right of Hillary Clinton, his eyes like everyone else's, riveted to the screen is Dennis McDonough. McDonough was deputy national security advisor when Navy SEALs descended on the terrorist mastermind lair in Pakistan. He went on to serve as Obama's chief of staff, where he spent 4 years running the executive branch. With that resume, the Minnesota could have scored many jobs at the dawn of Joe Biden's presidency. Instead, Biden appointed him to take the reins of the Department of Veteran Affairs, where McDonough promised to restore trust in a perpetually maligned agency that has faced longstanding criticism. I just remember watching what we were able to witness there and thinking of myself, I wish the country could see what I can see, McDonough, 54, told USA Today, recalling the bin Laden raid. There's so much second-guessing whether the country can do big things. And I've seen time again that night and here at VA that we do big things and we do them well. McDonough is entering his fourth year, leading the largest integrated healthcare network in the country, fighting for the same men and women he watched deploy to war zones as a top national security and presidential aide. But it hasn't been without challenges. McDonough has been tasked with handling a tsunami of benefit claims after the rollout of the biggest expansion to veteran benefits in decades, providing care during a global pandemic, reducing backlogs of claims, addressing hot-button social issues, and modernizing records to standardize quality and care. Through it all, McDonough says his mission has remained the same: be transparent, be accountable, and fight like hell for vets. Our job is to make sure that they get access to the care and the benefits that they earn. And that's what we do here every day, he said. Not always perfectly, that's for darn sure, but we take it seriously, deadly seriously. Running to the problems. The VA has a muddy track record when it comes to caring for the 9 million enrolled veterans. The agency, for decades, has received the complaints over inadequate health care, wait times for benefits, and excessive spending. The VA saw two secretaries and three acting secretaries during former President Donald Trump's single term. The turmoil of VA leadership during the Trump administration, which led to Trump firing one VA secretary via Twitter, aligned with several controversies related to ethic violations and fighting among senior leaders. But the VA has long vexed secretaries of both parties. Now it's McDonough's turn as he faces challenges, including high rates of veteran suicide, continued backlogs, problems transitioning to electronic health records, and finding ways to establish relationships with veterans who are new to the VA system as benefits expand. McDonough has been straightforward from the start. Success at the VA is measured by whether veterans feel like they're getting timely access to world-class health care and the benefits they've earned. We do that by running to the problems, not running away from them, he told USA Today, hacking away at the backlog. The VA is also working to tackle a backlog of benefit claims. As of mid-February, around 387,000 claims have been pending for more than 125 days. But Veterans of Foreign Wars Washington Office Executive Director Ryan Gallucci, who served in Iraq, said the VA has set clear expectations regarding the times to process claims. It has not heard recent complaints from veterans regarding the time it takes to get benefits. Given the volume and the total workload that it's taking up, that the average days to complete is 150 days. I think anyone who tries to present it in any other way just completely misunderstands the disability claim process and the actual experience of veterans who go through it. Cal McAllister, a Marine veteran who visits a VA clinic in Charlotte, North Carolina, said he hasn't had issues with the backlog, especially over the last few years. I would say it's been noticeable. The improvement in the quality and continuity, especially in the mental health clinic, the 31-year-old said. Tackling veterans' mental health. Under McDonald's leadership, the VA established the shortened Veterans Crisis Line, dial 988, then press 1 for veterans to connect quickly with crisis support 24/7. The agency has fielded more than 1.1 million calls and texts and chats since July 2022. But Justin Brown, the CEO of a bipartisan veteran advocacy firm, Nibbets Group, said the VA has been behind the times in their approach to veteran suicide. "We are not being very proactive in trying to find ways to help veterans live a higher quality of life earlier in life, including in military service," Brown, a Navy veteran, said. McDonald acknowledges that mental health is a fundamental pillar in VA care. The agency is working to innovate mental health care in a post-COVID world by connecting veterans via telehealth to mental health providers in areas that are lacking resources. The VA has also started to modernize all records, an effort to ensure veterans have complete electronic records regardless of location. It's currently deployed in 5 hospitals, but in reset mode, McDonough says. "There have been significant problems at these facilities, and the U.S. Government Accountability Office found contributed to patient safety risks. We're trying to provide to prove that the underlying technology actually works," McDonough said, adding that the VA will not deploy the system to other locations until it works properly. PACT Act expands benefits. Jim Roberts spent 1 year in Vietnam serving in the U.S. Army, where he drank water out of streams and bought locally grown food from villagers. This led the 77-year-old to seek care from the VA decades later over concerns of exposure to Agent Orange, an infamous toxic defoilant used during the Vietnam War that can cause cancer and other diseases. The area I was in Vietnam was the second most heavily dosed with Agent Orange, Robert said. The VA has granted billions of dollars in toxic exposure benefits to more than 500,000 veterans and survivors exposed to burn pits and chemicals since the PACT, P-A-C-T Act, was signed into law in 2022. The legislation marked the largest expansion of veterans' assistance and benefits in decades. More than 5 million veterans like Roberts have been screened for toxic exposures, according to the VA. For McDonough, the passage of the PACT Act posed both an immense opportunity and a heavy lift. He began the largest outreach campaign in the history of the VA. Despite concerns that the agency may become overwhelmed, to contact veterans eligible for benefits, even texting those who have never visited a VA health center. I think they're really proactive. They didn't just pass a law, sit back, hope it reached veterans by osmosis, and then went there, Joe Pensler, a Marine Corps veteran, told USA Today of the PACT Act rollout. Plensler also serves as communication advisor for the nonprofit group, We the Veterans and Military Families. The Veterans Benefit Administration started aggressively hiring, creating the largest workforce the administration has ever had and the highest growth rate in personnel in the past two decades. The agency also started a weekly public dashboard showing the current backlog, wait times, and the number of veterans who have made claims. The VA is currently beating projections for timely access to benefits applied for under the PACT Act. At the end of fiscal year 2023, the agency was processing claims 12 days faster than the prior year, according to the department. Abortion transgender issues. The VA changed a long-standing reproductive health policy in 2022 to provide abortion counseling and, in certain circumstances, abortions to female veterans. The decision received backlash from Republicans in Congress and is currently facing several legal challenges in states that have restrictive abortion laws. With women being the fastest-growing cohort of veterans using VA services, McDonough said it was an obvious decision for how the agency should address abortion care. I really face no choice, he said. We need to make sure that our veterans have access to the full suite of care when they're facing those questions about their reproductive options. The VA has also received backlash over its decision to support transgender veterans by providing hormone treatments. While some critics say it's a step too far, others are frustrated McDowell hasn't gone far enough to provide gender-affirming care as part of veterans' health benefits. But McDonough says the agency has yet to make the next step in that process. We're preparing to be in a position to provide gender-affirming surgery as well, he said. We're in the process of developing rules to do that. The VA secretary says he's staying out of the cultural wars. I'm not sure what the politics of it all are, but that's somebody else's job, he said. I don't do politics in this job. Get it right this time. While there are still challenges, the VA is setting all time records for delivering care and benefits to veterans under McDowell's leadership, and many are taking notice. For the past 3 years, I've seen the VA professionalize and enhance its role in the VSO space, Tiffany Ellett, the Director of Veterans Affairs and Rehabilitation at the American Legion, said. Veteran advocacy groups told USA Today McDowell's background in public service and working for the national security sphere at some of the highest levels of government is helping him lead the troubled agency. But McDowell has never served in the armed forces, making him only the second VA secretary in history who is a non-veteran. He thought it would cost him the job. I just figured there'd be a problem, he said. The Senate confirmed McDowell by a vote of 87-7. Former Secretary of State John Kerry, a Vietnam veteran who worked with McDonnell during Obama's second term, said McDonnell is unbelievably earnest with a fierce sense of right and wrong. Veterans, specifically those who have never given the VA a chance or previously did not have a good experience with the agency. We are bound and determined to get it right this time. It is the most important thing we can do, he said. He recounted a meeting with a veteran at a facility in Tennessee who was wearing a Vietnam veteran hat. McDonough told the vet, "Welcome home." He began to cry, McDonough said. He said, "Nobody ever said that to me." Imagine that, 50 years since he returned from Vietnam, and nobody has ever said that to him. That's the obligation we have to take care of those guys. And we will. Turning to another article on page one of USA Today this Friday, perception muddles COVID-19 protocols. Amid reports this week that federal officials are considering changing COVID-19 isolation guidelines, experts offered reminders that the coronavirus remains dangerous, killing more than 1,000 people a week nationwide and more than 2,000 a week as of last month. But the approach to prevention has shifted now that most Americans have been infected and vaccinated at least once. There are also treatments available for the most vulnerable, though they are dangerously underused, and most of the people who end up hospitalized are among the vulnerable groups who miss the opportunity to get an updated vaccine or a timely treatment, experts say. We're not going to prevent COVID anymore. People are going to get COVID, said Dr. Anand Parekh, chief medical advisor for the Bipartisan Policy Center, a think tank. But most important is preventing hospitalizations, severe illness, and deaths in the face of a virus that is much more transmissible than the flu or that, and then a regular rhinovirus that gives you a common cold, he said. So how hard should you be trying to avoid COVID-19, and what should you do if you get it? That depends on your level of risk and risk tolerance, experts say. The science has not changed, but the public's perception has, and the willingness of the public to inconvenience themselves has definitely dropped since the early days of the pandemic, said Dr. Daniel Griffin, an infectious disease specialist with Optum and co-host of the podcast This Week in Virology. Even early in the pandemic, when 2,000 people were dying daily in New York, the vast majority of Americans decided that isolating themselves when they fell ill was inconvenient, he said. About 75% of people typically hide their illness when they are sick, even though they know it might be harmful to others because they don't want to miss out, especially on social activities, according to a recent study. People are already going to the office. They're going to school. They're not taking their antihistamine, and no one notices, he said. Oh, they are taking the antihistamine. Most people have been quick to forget the lessons learned during 4 years of the pandemic, Griffin said. For the elderly, for the immunocompromised, we're turning back to our previous rugged individual approach to public health. What if you get rich, get sick? Anyone who has respiratory illness, a cough, stuffy nose, often a fever, should assume they have either COVID-19, the flu, or RSV, each of which kills tens of thousands of vulnerable Americans a year, said Dr. Paul Offit, a pediatrician and infectious disease specialist as the chief hospital at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. We've added COVID-19 to the pantheon of winter respiratory viruses, he said. Offit recommends that people at risk for severe disease from COVID-19, including those who are pregnant, immunocompromised, or over 65, get tested quickly if they develop these symptoms so they can benefit from the very effective available treatments, Paxlovid and the antiviral Molnupiravir. People who are not at high risk should assume they have one of these highly contagious infections and wear a mask to protect the vulnerable, he says. Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease specialist at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, says he's one of the few people in his Nashville, Tennessee region still masking in public. He and his wife are caring for a family member undergoing chemotherapy for cancer, and he doesn't want to bring anything home. Schaffner said the government should offer more attention and support for treating high-risk people who catch COVID-19. Many doctors are hesitant to prescribe Paxlovid, even to extremely vulnerable patients, because they don't understand the medication. He says he wished there was a 911 equivalent that doctors could call for advice. Parikh, speaking on day 9 of his own mild COVID-19 infection, said the current system assumes people at high risk will be willing and able to go through 9 hoops to get Paxlovid. When is it okay to return to work? Still testing positive, but with a faint red line, Parikh from the Bipartisan Policy Center said he stayed home for the first 3 days and then benefited from a weekend before running to work wearing an N95 mask to conform to CDC guidelines. I've been asking myself, just in terms of the convenience, how often people could do this, said Parikh, acknowledging that not everyone can work from home or time their infection for a weekend. He's worried that much of the public is now a few years away from this last vaccination and people are not staying home if they're sick. So it's likely that a lot more people potentially could be walking around with COVID-19 and be infectious. On a recent trip, Offit saw and heard an airport cleaner sniffling, sneezing, and coughing. He watched people's faces change as they saw the man and they quickly moved away. If we value human life, he said, we should make it easier for people who are sick to take a day off. It would also save businesses money in the long run if one sick worker didn't get all the co-workers sick, he said. But at the very least, he should have worn a mask, Offit said, of the worker. Dr. Michael Mina has been a fan of rapid testing since the earliest days of the pandemic and says they can still play a vital role in fighting COVID-19. Mina, an immunologist, says he thinks people should test themselves if they think they might have COVID-19 and stay home if at all possible, if they test positive, particularly if the line is strongly red. If it is positive, especially if it's dark, you know you're infectious, said Mina. Also chief science officer at eMed, a home testing company. Typically, he said, people are most contagious in the first few days of an illness. Mina's upset with new state regulations in California and Oregon, which may become a federal model. These rules say people should isolate only if they have a fever and other symptoms are mild or improving. Fever is a terrible metric for deciding whether someone is contagious with COVID-19, Mina said. Many people are contagious without ever having symptoms or having symptoms other than fever. Other people may feel quite sick with COVID-19, but the virus is contained in their gastrointestinal system rather than shedding from their respiratory tract, so they wouldn't be contagious, he said. A test from a person in this scenario would show up negative. Symptoms alone have always been a poor indicator, both positive symptoms and the absence of symptoms, Mina says. Should sick people isolate? Guidance from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention still calls for people to isolate themselves for 5 days if they test positive and then wear a mask in public for 5 days. There were reports this week that the guidance was about to change, but CDC officials said they're not ready to make a change quite yet. Several experts said it makes sense to change the rules because few people are following the current guidelines. Any change needs to be supported by lots of public communication, Offit said. The CDC should be out in front of the media every other day and explain what's going on. He said if they want to change a recommendation, they should be explaining the science behind the change and keep pounding it out there. The goal of any policy change should be to get people to isolate for the first 2 to 3 days of illness when people are the most contagious, said Griffin, an infectious disease specialist. If you can actually come up with guidance that more people will follow, you can effectively reduce the amount of people out there who are highly transmissible, he said. Should I get vaccinated? Yes. All the experts say yes. Vaccination is still worth the effort and sore arm, particularly for people in high-risk groups or for anyone who doesn't want to miss an important life event like a wedding or a trip. Most Americans got their last shot more than a year ago, which means when they catch COVID, the immunity they got from it will have faded. They won't get as sick as a person who's never been vaccinated or exposed to the virus at all, but they will get sicker than if they'd had a recent shot, experts say. That's just how the immune system works. Immune protection typically fades over time, which is why people can catch a cold year after year. Plus, most viruses, like the one that causes COVID-19, mutate over time, so the body isn't prepared for precisely the one that arrives the year after an infection or a shot. A vaccine like an infection or probably even an exposure that's not enough to cause illness, Mina says, gives the body a reminder, a memory boost that helps it fight off illness. The current COVID-19 vaccine doesn't prevent all infections, but a vaccine almost certainly reduces the severity of illness, experts say, along with the risk for long COVID, in which symptoms linger for months or years after the initial infection is gone. In terms of side effects, most people will still get a sore arm. Some people feel lousy for a day or two. People who had a severe reaction to an earlier dose of the COVID-19 vaccine should talk to their doctors before getting another one. For everyone else, the vaccines available in the United States and worldwide have been shown to be remarkably safe overall. Anything given to tens of millions of healthy people will have negative consequences for some. Teenage boys and young men have a higher risk for myocarditis and pericarditis, a swelling of the heart muscle and area around the heart, but Mina noted that the risk for these is higher during a COVID-19 infection than during a vaccination. Vaccination during pregnancy has also been known to be safe and to protect the newborn. The bottom line, Offit said, if you're sick and can't stay home, wear a mask. The goal is to keep people out of the hospital, out of the ICU, and out of the morgue, he said. And now, another article from page one of USA Today, section hour one. As we gather, seems like almost nothing is safe. Continued gun violence has now become part of the American psyche. A Super Bowl victory parade in Kansas City, Missouri, has become another joyful celebration marred by gun violence in the United States, a lurking danger that hovers over Americans as they gather together to celebrate, honor, and commemorate. The chance that a single event might become the scene of violence is relatively small, but tragedy after tragedy has become part of the national psyche. Meanwhile, some politicians and advocates are again questioning where in America it is truly safe to gather in celebration. In 2017, a gunman shot more than 11,000 rounds of ammunition at an outdoor country music concert near his Las Vegas hotel as fans crouched in terror, killing 60. In 2022, a man with a rifle fired into a July 4th parade outside Chicago. Parents frantically ran, some holding their children, and seven died. And now, 11 children were shot in the moments after a Super Bowl victory parade in Kansas City on Wednesday, where thousands of red-clad fans ran for their lives across confetti-strewn streets. In total, 22 people suffered gunshot wounds, including one fatality. Interim Fire Chief Ross Grundison said, "I think that's something that all of us who are parents, who are just regular people living each day, have to decide what we wish to do about," said Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas, who attended the parade with his wife and mother and who had to run for cover when gunfire broke out. Parades, rallies, schools, movies, it seems like almost nothing is safe, he said. Bullets at a sports event, parades, concerts are still relatively rare, but they resonate deeply in a nation that has a long tradition of gathering and celebrating together. Last year, the United States experienced 10 fatal public mass shootings, which killed 72 people, according to USA Today's Mass Killing Database, a partnership with the Associated Press and Northeastern University. That's the most in a year since tracking began in 2006. And this ends the second part. The shooting is yet another reminder that no parade, no church, no school, really nowhere at all, is safe from America's gun violence crisis, says the president of Everytown for Gun Safety after the Kansas City shooting. Kevin Sanders, 53, of Lenexa, Kansas, summed it up even more simply. "It sucks that someone had to ruin the celebration," he said after hearing the gunshots while being in the crowd for Wednesday's parade. Renewed calls for stricter laws. In Kansas City, more than 800 law enforcement officials were on hand to provide security along the parade route, said Police Chief Stacy Graves. But in a nation awash in guns, it's hard for law enforcement to prevent such attacks. Some leaders and activists say they meant the nation needs stricter gun laws in general. Lucas has joined with mayors across the country in calling for new laws to reduce gun violence, including mandating universal background checks. Moms Demand Action Executive Director Angela Farah Zabala said the shooting should prompt politicians to tighten gun laws. She said the Super Bowl victory parade should have been pure joy, but became a tragedy for the community. American attitudes toward gun violence seems to be shifting slightly. 6 in 10 adults last year said gun violence was a very big problem in the U.S., up 9 percentage points from 2022, according to the Pew Research Center. Almost 2 in 3 said they expect the level of gun violence to increase in the next 5 years. The Super Bowl, watched this year by more than 1 in 3 Americans, is the most unifying event in America, President Joe Biden said late Wednesday. Nothing brings us together. And the celebration of a Super Bowl win is a moment that brings a joy that can't be matched to the winning team and their supporters. For this joy to be turned to tragedy today in Kansas City cuts deep into the American soul. He called for a ban on assault weapons, limits on high-capacity magazines, and strengthened background checks. Today's events should move us, shock us, shame us into action. What are we waiting for? What else do we need to see? He said. Parade worries were different. When the San Francisco 49ers won the Super Bowl in 1982, their city threw a disastrous parade in part because officials had planned for 25,000 people and instead 500,000 people showed up. It was a pair case of civil negligence, the San Francisco Chronicle wrote, because police moved part of the parade route to accommodate the crowd, meaning many who had lined up for hours never got to see their team go by. It was the worst parade I never saw, 49ers fan John Sheraton told the paper. Today, officials must speak to the other issues. I appreciate the bravery and coordination of the law enforcement officers, first responders, healthcare workers for ensuring a swift, orderly evacuation and caring for the victims. Representative Sharice Davids of Kansas, of neighboring Kansas City, Kansas, wrote on X, formerly Twitter. The traumatic memories of today will stick with children, families, community members for far too long. This does not reflect the spirit of Kansas City, and I support those asking for a chance to ensure a brighter and a safer future. The police chief's parade shooting stems from personal dispute. The shooting Wednesday that wounded more than 20 people and killed one at a celebration for the Kansas City Chiefs Super Bowl victory appears to stem from a personal dispute. Authorities said Thursday, peoples detained three people at the rally, including two juveniles, and recovered several firearms, said Police Chief Stacy Graves. She did not identify the three people in custody, and they have not been arrested. Police are working to determine the involvement of others, Graves said. However, there was no nexus to terrorism or homegrown violent extremism. The bullets ripped through the crowd after close to 1 million Chiefs fans clad in Kansas City's red, white, and gold had followed the parade several miles through the heart of downtown to rally on the lawn outside Union Station and hear speeches by players and by coaches. More than 800 law enforcement officers were providing security for the parade route, Graves said. The victims, ranging in age from 8 to 47, said Graves, and at least half are younger than 16. The 11 injured children are expected to recover. At least two people remained in critical condition Thursday, University Health said. The hospital received 8 of the gunshot victims and had discharged 5. The shooting killed Lisa Lopez Galvin, a mother of 2 and host of Taste of Tijuana radio station KKFI, confirmed. Multiple Kansas City Chiefs players, some of whom spoke to the crowd shortly before shots were fired, took to social media to ask for prayers for the victims, thank first responders, and to demand gun reform. I'm heartbroken over the tragedy that took place today, wrote Travis Kelce, Chiefs tight end. Videos from the scene showed throngs of people ducking and running for cover as gunfire and screams ran out. One video showed two people tackle and pin another person to the ground until officers arrived. Trey Filter, a 40-year-old lifelong Chiefs fan, said he joined a group effort to tackle a person who opened fire into the crowds of fans. There was a frenzy. People were freaking out. Filter and his family were leaving the parade for their home in Wichita, Kansas, when shots first broke out, scattering the crowd. When he heard a woman shout that someone had a gun, he just went for it. As another man tried to restrain the shooter's hands, Filter reached underneath the shooter to feel for the gun but could not find it. I started hitting him in the ribs, Filter said. He didn't let up until police pulled him off by his feet. Meanwhile, Filter's wife picked up the shooter's weapon, a huge assault rifle. Once police had the situation under control, Filter and his family didn't stick around. And like many others, they left as soon as they could. Israeli troops storm main hospital in Gaza. Health officials say many wounded in incursion. Israeli forces on Thursday conducted a dramatic raid into Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza, aiming to locate the remains of captives held by Hamas. Gaza's health ministry spokesperson, Ashraf al-Qaeda, described the massive incursion, punctuated by gunfire that left many people wounded in the hospital. Gaza's largest still-functioning medical facility that also houses thousands displaced by the war. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, Israel's chief military spokesman, said Israeli forces were acting on credible intelligence that Hamas had held hostages there, and said troops were conducting a precise and limited operation and would not forcibly evacuate doctors or patients. However, al-Qaeda said Israeli forces had ordered medics to move patients into an older building that was not equipped to treat those in need. Many cannot evacuate, such as those with lower limb amputations, severe burns, or the elderly. Video of the strike showed a terrifying scene as doctors rushed to wheel patients on stretchers through smoke-filled hallways as gunfire rumbled, the Associated Press reported, noting that the video could not be authenticated but was consistent with AP's reporting. Dr. Khaled Asir, one of the remaining surgeons at the hospital, said patients injured Thursday were already being treated for past war-related wounds. The situation is escalating every hour and every minute, he said. People have been forced into an impossible situation, said a member of the aid group Doctors Without Borders. Stay at Nasser Hospital against the Israeli military orders and become a potential target, or exit the compound into an apocalyptic landscape where bombings and evacuation orders are a part of daily life. The Israeli-Hamas war, which began after Hamas' brutal border attacks on October 7th left 1,200 dead, has taken a staggering toll. Hamas militants took 250 people hostage. About 130 captives remain in Gaza, a quarter of whom are believed to be dead. Over 28,000 Palestinians have been killed since then in the Gaza war, and 80% of the population has been displaced, officials estimate. Late Wednesday, at least 11 people were killed, including four children, in airstrikes in central Gaza, officials said. Relatives gathered around bodies wrapped in white shrouds outside the hospital in Deir al-Bala before the remains were placed in a trunk to be transported for burial. Hezbollah vows to retaliate after Israel Israeli airstrikes. The war shows no sign of ending, and the risk of a broader conflict is growing as Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah step up attacks. More Israeli airstrikes were reported in southern Lebanon on Thursday, a day after a barrage that prompted the Lebanese militant group to vow revenge. The civilian death toll from two Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon rose to 10, Lebanese state media said Thursday. The Wednesday assault hit in the city of Nabatea and a village in southern Lebanon just hours after an Israeli soldier was killed in a strike from Lebanon. Lebanon's prime minister denounced the escalation at a time where we are insisting on calm and call on all sides to not escalate. We find the Israeli enemy extending its aggression, read a statement from the prime minister's office. Biden's proposal would broaden student debt relief. The Biden administration is proposing an ambitious new way to determine which low-income Americans could qualify for student debt relief. Under the plan rolled out by the Education Department on Thursday, the federal government would consider the life challenges that prevent certain borrowers from making progress on their loans when assessing if a person is eligible for student loan forgiveness, whether a borrower has a disability or other, quote, high cost burdens for essential expenses, such as costs related to health care or caring for a loved one, would become bigger factors in the agency's thinking. Household income, the person's assets, and their age would be considered as well. Department of Education says the suggested regulation would bring automatic relief for borrowers who are highly likely to be in default in 2 years, potentially giving forgiveness to hundreds of thousands of those borrowers, at least. Advocates say Thursday the proposal on the whole could pave the way for relief for tens of millions. The White House said it doesn't immediately identify exactly how many borrowers the proposal could affect. On a call with reporters on Thursday, the White House press secretary said the announcement is part of President Joe Biden's commitment to keep pushing for widespread student loan forgiveness, even after conservatives on the Supreme Court doomed his first far-reaching plan this summer. He promised he wasn't done fighting for student loan borrowers. The announcement follows months of pressure from progressives who've called on the Education Department to be more ambitious in its student loan relief efforts, despite the legal hurdles. In statements to USA Today, student loan relief advocates praised the administration for heeding their calls. Upon enacting this proposal, federal policy will finally recognize what Americans from all walks of life have known for decades. Too often, higher education does not deliver on its promise of economic mobility and financial stability, and borrowers and their families should not be sentenced to a lifetime of debt as a result, said the deputy executive director at the Student Borrower Protection Center. Progressive lawmakers lauded the announcement, including Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. This is a meaningful next step in the fight to cancel student debt for many more Americans, she said. Representative Virginia Fox of North Carolina, who chairs the House Education Committee, has been a chief critic of Biden's student loan policies, derided Thursday's announcement. Student debt is skyrocketing, college completion rates are abysmal, and schools have zero accountability for the overpriced degrees they offer, she said in a statement. Voters don't want to be bought. Education Department officials will debate the new plan with federal negotiators during the agency's final session of its student loan relief. Talks slated for later next week. USA Today first reported the department's decision to add the final session to specifically discuss relief for borrowers suffering financial hardship. In just a brief blurb, the privately built Odysseus lander is officially on its way to the moon in the goal of becoming the first commercial U.S. vehicle to ever make it to the lunar surface. The probe hitched a ride to orbit aboard the SpaceX Falcon 9, which launched at 1:05 on Thursday from NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida. The launch, which has been delayed from Wednesday due to an error with the rocket's methane fuel, comes a little over a month after another American company's lander tried and failed to reach the moon. If it makes it to the lunar surface, Houston-based Initiative Machines spacecraft would also hail the first American moon landing in more than 50 years. Intuitive Machines built the Odessa spacecraft to carry cargo for NASA and other customers to the lunar surface for its IM-1 mission. Less than an hour after the Falcon 9 launch, they reported that its lander had separated from the rocket's second stage and the system was operating as planned. And this completes the reading of USA Today Hour 1 this Friday, February 16, 2024. I'm Tom Breed, wishing each of you a good day and a good weekend. Thank you.